podcast is part of the Sports Social Podcast Network.
Jones! Bowden!
He's got it! England have won the World Cup by the barest of margins!
Stokes flashes it away through the covers for four, and England have won the match!
Hello, welcome to the Analyst Inside Cricket with me, Simon Hughes.
And me, Simon Mann.
And we'll be with you all season, of course, with the County Championship only a week away. I actually got my Cricketer magazine wall chart up there already, looking at the early season matches that I would like to go to. And of course, at the moment, the cricket dominating most people's lives is, certainly in India anyway, is the IPL. We're going to talk about that today, and specifically, we're going to talk about fielding, actually, which is perhaps one of the disciplines of the game which is less focused on, although very important, of course. And one of the reasons, actually, I thought about talking about the fielding today is because I notice it's one of my old teammates' birthdays today, Graham Barlow. Now, those of an older vintage will remember him, not just for his fantastic left-hand batting, but also for his brilliant fielding. He was a specialist cover fielder. In fact, Middlesex were lucky in the 1980s that we had Graham Barlow on one side and Roland Butcher, the original Hoover, who would charge in from any position on the ground and Hoover the ball up with one hand and hurl it over the stumps and took incredible diving catches as well. So we had those two men on either side. I think they probably helped my bowling figures massively.
Well, something had to, didn't it? Y'all, let's face it. So Graham Barlow then and Roland Butcher, how much attention did they put into their fielding practice? You know, you think about nets, bowling, batting, you'd have done that, turn up for nets, pre-season, whatever. How much attention did those two put into their fielding at a time when fielding was sort of not optional, was it? But it was just beginning to become important because of the advent of one-day cricket. What did they do?
Well, I think fielding practice in those days was a bit of a token. It seemed to be mostly about high catches, like skyers, taking skyers, which were quite fun. And it was a challenge to have, you know, you divide the team into two and, you know, see who dropped the most or something. But actually was fairly irrelevant because a lot of the time you're doing ground fielding rather than taking high catches. How many high catches do you actually take in a season? You know, I don't know, half a dozen or something. And yet you seem to spend an inordinate amount of time, or we used to spend an inordinate amount of time practicing it. But what Barlow and Butcher did particularly was practice the low prowl in the covers, getting low to the ground and swooping in and picking the ball up one-handed either side. And then sort of, you know, aiming at the stump. So we did quite a bit of the cover fielding practice where, you know, you're almost like a cat sort of moving in. And then as the coach rolls it or hits it out towards you, you try and pounce on the ball and hurl it over the stumps or at the stumps. And they were both particularly good at that. And I think that's why they were good. It was also about, actually, and we're going to hear from a fielding coach, a fielding specialist in a bit, Trevor Penny, who's now with the Rajasthan Royals in the IPL, but has done a lot of fielding coaching around the world and was a brilliant fielder himself. And he says that, you know, being low centre of gravity, low to the ground, is a very good asset to have as a fielder. And that's why a lot of wicket keepers are very good fielders, because they've got strong thighs and they're used to being low to the ground.
Mm. So what proportion of time would you have spent fielding, you know, doing fielding practice compared to bowling and batting in the nets?
Well, I hardly ever batted in the nets, of course, because I was a low-order batsman. But I would say a fair degree of fielding practice, actually, but not always that focused on your own position. You know, it was a general session. And actually, normally, if we'd had a bad day, the coach the next day ordered you in for naughty boy nets. And part of that naughty boy nets was whacking the ball as hard as he could at you from close range so that you had a damaged finger and couldn't play the next game.
Utterly pointless. Absolutely, utterly pointless.
Yeah, no, totally true. But obviously now it's much more forensic. And actually, what prompted me to talk about fielding today was Jimmy Anderson the other day at the MCC Cowdery Lecture at Lord's. So he was on stage with his tailenders colleagues, Felix White and Greg James, and also Stuart Broad. And they were talking about, you know, different aspects of the game. And one of the things Jimmy said was how much he loved fielding. Let's just hear what Jimmy had to say that night.
from the start, I was a fielder. genuinely, I loved fielding at square leg and diving around, getting grass stains on my whites. My mum hated it, but trying to take diving catches and stops and run out, getting run outs and stuff like that, because I was pretty average at both batting and bowling. It wasn't until I was 15 that I actually started getting better at bowling and thought that actually I could do something with it. But I think that that's something that not a lot of people have, especially play professional cricket. They don't love fielding, and I think that is something, one of the reasons I'm still going is because I absolutely love it. I love chasing the ball to boundary. I love trying to claw it back in at the last minute and save four runs or take a diving catch. I absolutely love that.
Actually, he was a man after my own heart there, Jimmy, because I felt the same way. I loved diving around on a one-day match, trying to stop the ball from going over the rope, sliding stops and occasionally trying to take a diving catch. I loved that kind of exhibition of the game. It was almost like, and it certainly is now, it was almost like a combination of circus and sport at times, with the old comedy value thrown in if you dived over it or something. And actually picking the ball up on the outfield and throwing it over the stumps flat as well was something I loved doing. I got quite good at that by spending a lot of my summer holidays on a stony beach in Kent and just putting a Coke can or whatever I could find, a bit of litter, on a breakwater, you know, 30 metres away, and just throwing tons of stones at it, or having games throwing stones into the water and then trying to land another stone into the circle that the first stone had created in the water or something like that. And I just love that exhibition of throwing the ball, which I think, again, is something Anderson enjoys as well. Did you? Were you a fan of that as a club cricketer?
What, throwing stone at a can?
I was thinking more actually fielding, obviously.
No, I love fielding. I actually loved it. But I think if you're, I don't know, perhaps some people are made for fielding more than others. And also I think some people like fielding more than others. Some people, I think at the times when I played, that a lot of people just liked bowling or they just liked batting. And when they couldn't do that, they just felt the game was over, which, of course, is a team game. It's so frustrating for the other members of the team if someone, you know, I don't know, would bowl six overs at the start, you know, take 2 for 10 and then go and stand at fine leg. And every time the ball came to them, the ball went through their hands, you know. So you actually, what you've gained, you give away sort of later in the afternoon. So I used to find that, you know, really frustrating. The other thing that really stuck in my mind was when I was younger. I can't remember who said this to me once, is you spend more time fielding in cricket than you do anything else, so therefore you've got to learn to love it. And you've got to be that, you almost got to be like a bowler as a fielder, haven't you? Can I take a wicket? And that means a run out or a catch or building some pressure in the field on a batter who then might give a catch.
Yeah, actually I was clearing up some old cuttings and other cricket sort of paraphernalia from my parents' house, because we're now, it's a strange moment actually, that they've both passed away in the last 2 or 3 years, and so we're now selling the house, and it's been in the Hughes family for 60 odd years, so there's a lot of memories there.
I saw your game in the garden, Yoz, on Instagram.
Yeah. Still getting
your final game, is it?
Final game, exactly. Final game in the garden. That's where I learnt to bowl when I was six, in that garden in Ealing, actually. And my mother particularly kept lots of cuttings of times that when I was playing for Middlesex. I found one cutting, said Hughes didn't bowl very well, but he took a brilliant catch. So at least I had a decent day in some respects.
And the other point about that, of course, is, you know, if you drop a catch, it can be worth 130 runs, can't it? I mean, you think of some of the catches that were dropped in that Test series, how vital they were. Ollie Robinson's drop catch, you could argue, cost England a Test match, possibly even a series. If he'd taken that catch at mid-wicket to get rid of Jude Jarrell when he'd had 59 in that Test match, England might have gone on to win that game. And you think of Ollie Pope being dropped in that first Test match. He played brilliantly, but he was dropped a couple of times. If that first catch had been taken, well, there wouldn't have been the heist of Hyderabad. England wouldn't have had that glorious victory and made everyone optimistic at the start of the series. But yeah, so, you know, you can do all this work with the bat and the ball, but if you drop a catch, then it can have a massive impact on a game, as we know. Well, the old cliche, catches win matches, and drop catches definitely lose games.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. Do you pick out any, you've been doing the IPL for the last couple of days, any sort of brilliant moments, either in the field or elsewhere?
Yeah, well, and there was one in the KKR game the other day, KKR against Sunrisers. Narine sent to open the batting, and he can be quite dangerous, can't he, at the top of the order, because he's just got license. He hasn't got a sort of stylish technique, but he can just whack it, and he just stands there and delivers. But he was at the non-striker's end, and he came halfway down, and the ball was picked up at backward point, and a dead-eyed throw from Shahbaz Ahmed knocked out the middle stump at, you know, at the non-striker's end, and he literally was not in the frame. You know, you could not see him. He was still out of shot trying to get back. He'd sort of half given up. So, you know, those brilliant moments, and that might have, you know, that's KKR actually went on to win that game in a, you know, tight match, and some brilliant hitting from Heinrich Klassen. Goodness me, that was astonishing. Talk about the heist of Hyderabad. He nearly pulled off something special at Eden Gardens. And the other run out that stands in my mind was Johnny Bairstow's first dismissal in this IPL, where he was actually at the non-striker's end as well, and the ball was driven back, and Ishant Sharma just... isn't it funny, isn't it? You know, you can talk... It's worth the same. The brilliant throw from Shahbaz Ahmed at backward point is worth the same as Ishant just getting his fingertips on it, on his follow-through, deflecting the ball onto the stumps, and Johnny Bairstow was trying to desperately to get back, and he was out. You know, a sort of fluke dismissal, really. That's all, you know, once in half a season sort of dismissal, or once in a season you get that, don't you, as a batter. But it actually probably just sort of summed up, almost seemed to sum up Johnny Bairstow's winter. But the sort of the two sides, really, of fielding, same result, but, you know, even that, isn't it? You know, I'm sure you've affected a run out backing up, haven't you? Just sort of just deflecting the ball onto your stumps. You must have done in the game, surely.
I don't actually remember one, but I've certainly been run out like that, enthusiastically backing up. It is the worst feeling. Actually, Johnny Bairstow's whole kind of sort of year, if you take it back to the Ashes last year, being run out by Alex Carey at Lords, seems to have kind of gone into free fall ever since, doesn't it? Nothing really kind of quite gone right for him, unfortunately, even though he's suggested that he would perform. So I suppose it's T20 and the IPL which have made fielding such a brilliant discipline of the game. It's become almost a sort of exhibition of fielding, hasn't it, the IPL, with the amount of sort of relay stops and incredible catches over the rope and so on, and players with the time to be able to practice it. And of course, now there is very few poor fielders in a game. I mean, going back to again my era, you know, there were lots of fielders, who bowlers particularly, who would just run around and stick a boot out at the boundary, on the boundary, and obviously it quite often bobbled over. Ian Botham was guilty of that off my bowling, actually, on one occasion. Now you don't get those.
You gave him a volley.
I did. I absolutely did.
Oh, did you? All right. That's very brave.
I did give him a volley. And, of course, what he then said was, well, at least I wasn't asleep at long leg.
Which, of course, did happen. Yeah. You did fall asleep in the field. So you talked about you enjoyed fielding, but there was a time when you fell asleep at five.
Unfortunately, I did. And you see, I think it was excusable because I wouldn't do it on a one-day game, because a one-day game was exciting and every ball was an event. But a four-day or three-day game was a bit slow. There were kind of soporific periods. And partly because I'd had a late night the night before, I did just shut my eyes for one ball when Botham was bowling. And unfortunately, it was the one ball that was tickled down to fine leg, wrapped into the boundary boards about a yard from me, and I never moved.
You know what I'm going to say here, don't you, folks? This is professional top-level cricket, and there are people falling asleep while they are doing it.
I'm sorry to admit that to anyone who happened to have been watching or supported Durham at the time. So it doesn't happen anymore like that, even though, you know, some of the IPL games go on until late in the night, where it's past a lot of people's bedtimes. And one of the people who's had a real inspiration, I think, on fielding in the IPL and in the game generally is Trevor Penny. Born in Zimbabwe, played for Warwickshire, came to England when he was quite young, and actually was a star player for Warwickshire in the year that they did the triple. They won three trophies in 1994, and he was very much an integral part of that Warwickshire side. He ran people out for fun from cover. He was unbelievably fast and brilliant and low to the ground. And of course, since then, since retirement, he was involved a little bit with England, actually, later on in his sort of just before retiring, and then became a full-time fielding coach and has fielding coached all over the world, not just in the IPL, but for the West Indies, for Sri Lanka, for teams in Australia and so on. So he is really a very much a fielding guru, even though now actually his official title is assistant coach at the Rajasthan Royals. Anyway, I thought I'd catch up with him. The Royals won their first match. The fielding was very good, actually. They took some good outfield catches. And I said to him, one of the reasons I wanted to talk about fielding today was having heard from Jimmy Anderson that it was his favourite part of the game.
Well, it's great to hear Jimmy Anderson's side of things, because I remember helping Duncan Fletcher way back. He called me in because there were a few drop catches in that 2005 test series, that good one. And I came in, Peterson had dropped a few catches, and he called me in, and I was 38. I said, oh, geez, I'll come and coach, but I don't know if I can be your 12th man. But I ended up getting on the field. But yeah, I've loved it ever since. My dad loved fielding as well, and they got me a Colin Bland book when I was young. And I always used to follow those drills that he used to do. And that was all about actually quality and what you did. It wasn't some fancy drill, which sometimes you see these days, and you don't actually get better. Those drills were, you got better. You started hitting the stumps more and your movement got better and that sort of stuff. So I always loved it. And I always felt if I didn't get runs, then I could try and get a run out or two or stop 15, 20 runs, and that would help team win. So, but I just loved running around. I loved playing hockey and all those sort of things, squash and tennis. So I think it helped, helped being a decent fielder from all those extra activities.
And you mentioned there Colin Bland. Obviously, that's going a long way back. But there's some sort of South African link, isn't there, with brilliant fielders? Because Colin Bland was the first. And then there was John T in the 90s and you. Yeah. And then I was thinking Herschel Gibbs and A.B. de Villiers as well. You know, and I'm sure there's others I've forgotten. You know, what is it about Southern Africans? I know you're Zimbabwean, but in the same part of the world. Yeah. What is it about you guys that makes you that good?
Well, Colin Bland was actually Zimbabwean. Rhodesian back in those days, and he got picked for South Africa. That's how good he was at batting and fielding. But I like I said, I think it's we were lucky enough at school that it was compulsory to play every sport, and you sort of became a little bit athletic, and everything was competitive. So whenever you were fielding against someone in practice, you wanted to be better than the other guy, and it was just competitive the whole time. So it increased your level of fielding, and that's just the way we sort of grew up. Is like if you can't get runs, you have to field well. So those guys you mentioned, Herschel and Jonty on the same field, was something to behold, wasn't it? I mean, geez, it was incredible. And yeah, that's just the joy of it. I think when I used to field, it was me against the batsman. I didn't care whether it was 104 overs like we used to play in county cricket. It would be every over of every ball. You know, it would be like that batsman's not getting a single or he's not hitting it past me. And if he tries, he's going to get run out of court. So that was my attitude. That's when I coach. Well, I'm assistant coach. Now, I did a lot of fielding coaching before, and so I'm sort of diversified a little bit, but I'm still passionate about that fielding side. And it's you've got to get that through, because a lot of people haven't got that. That's what I've noticed. Everyone wants to be a good fielder, but they don't put that work in. And two practices a week is not good enough. It has to come from within you, and you can't have the coach calling you each time. So I think that's the thing that I've tried. And then once you create a nice atmosphere and you feel that they're getting better, then they get better themselves and they come call you and they want the help.
Obviously, fielding has gone through the roof in its quality in the last, 15 years. I mean, obviously, the IPL T20s helped that. What's your, and I know now you're the assistant coach, but as you said, you've done a lot of fielding coaching around the world with different teams. And I remember seeing Trevor Bayliss, working with England and also being passionate about fielding and doing a lot of quite old-fashioned, old-school drills, which I thought, again, sort of emphasised the fun aspect. Is that something that you've tried to encourage?
Yeah, 100%. You can try and think up new fielding drills and stuff like that. You can have gimmicky ones, but like I said at the start, I still believe it's the ones where you actually have to do the old school ones and practice a certain thing, like throwing at the stump, for instance. I don't think that's got better in world cricket. Everyone's got better on the boundary, those brilliant diving catches, sharing it, lobbing it back from the outside. And the ball's being hit harder. So sometimes in the ring, it's just passing fielders. And so that sort of stuff, when I played, they didn't hit it that hard. So you could look better in the ring, I reckon. But it's an interesting one. I when it comes to practice, if you've got a certain amount of time, I'd rather break it down and say, right, today we're doing throwing at the stump from all different directions. We're going to have little competitions and then maybe come into one group one at the end and have a competition. That's the way I like doing it. If you've got no time and you just got a gimmicky drill that's everyone's throwing around and they hardly hit the stump, it's not really improving them, but it's just creating an atmosphere. So there's two types of fielding for me when it comes to coaching. You really got to get down and try and improve a certain aspect, or you can have a fun drill.
And how do you compare fielding now? I mean, you said that, you know, hitting the stumps isn't that much better than the past. What about the rest of it? How do you compare what you see now to what you were experienced 20 years ago?
I think they're much more athletic. There's no doubt everyone's fitter. I remember playing with our mate, Gladdy, and he was good when he wanted to be, but that old boot used to come out on the boundary and he was just a joy, but he rolled the house down, didn't he? So, but there's not that anymore. So even like Jimmy, that was a fine example for bowlers, to be honest. Even Alan Donald in my side, he was a really good fielder as well, and he took pride in that. I think the bowling side of things, the fielders have got better by a long way since when I played. All other fielders have got fitter. Their arms have got better, that's for sure. They're better on the boundary. I still believe that batting and bowling comes first. So whenever you, like, even if you come to an IPL and you try and set up a nice fielding drill, the guys are actually still more focused on the batting and bowling, which is sad. Because, like, I felt in the first game, if you saw Riyan Parag and Dhruv,
yeah, I did.
They actually seen 20 runs, and that was the difference of winning the game. So that was highlighted in our debrief. It's like, it was just amazing. So, yeah, it's still a bit of the forgotten thing in my view. I know it looks better and everything is better, but better athletes, better catchers, I reckon now. And certainly the bowlers are better fielders than they used to be, other than you, Sam.
I love fielding and I just like the kind of approach that is given to it now. Tell me about the practice methods of those boundary catches, for instance, which we see so often now. And they look like they're part sort of circus almost, as much as they are cricket. How do they practice them?
It's quite easy. You have to be good at hitting. So I think all the fielding coaches around the world have got good at sort of range hitting and getting exactly on the line. And you get sort of two people maybe 20 meters apart. You try and hit it in the middle and one of them will call, catch it, jump over the line and lob it over. So it's like everything. Once you get used to it and practice, it's great. In the West Indies side, when I was there for 2 years ago, Pollard and Trey Russ and all those guys who are just maybe two of the best I've ever seen on the boundary, and Jason Holder, actually. And it was great fun because you're trying to get them to drop it and mess it around. So you start having fun with them and testing them out. I think delivery of your hitting is very crucial. You can't just keep hitting it short or wide or over all the time. So that sort of thing. But, yeah, it's just generally practice and good practice, the way you can hit to them, I think.
And I suppose it's also the fielding coach's best friend would be those rubber bats, are they? Which kind of, without much effort, hits it about 80 metres.
Do you know, I don't know if I'm the only one, but I'm the one of the only ones that doesn't use that bat. So I like using the real bat and a full one, and it's the proper sound, and it comes off at the right sort of pace. So, yeah, some people, I think for lobbies, you know, like warming up before, just before you're going out and that, it's fine. You can just hit it up with that. But when it's actual fielding practice, and also the one thing with those high ones, I'm a big believer, is you go behind the stumps. So you're hitting 80 to 90 meters to the boundary, because it's unrealistic if you're just doing a 30-yard one, because it doesn't come like that. So I think the perfect practice from the perfect distance is the way to go forward with those boundary catches.
And presumably as well, I mean, you mentioned there Jurel, for instance, who took a good catch the other night, Dhruv Jurel. He's a keeper. And you've got Joss Butler, who's a keeper, also in the outfield as well. There's a kind of proliferation of keepers who are now outfielders. I mean, is it quite hard converting them into dynamic fielders?
No, they're better fielders than most, because, you know, the fielding, the wicket-keeping drills they do, they go side to side and they're always low to the ground. So when they come into extra cover or anywhere, they're better movers than the fielders. So I've always found that if you take Brendan McCullum, remember when he stopped keeping? Mm. He is one of the most electric fielders I've ever seen in my life. And he read it and he threw and he dived. And MS, when I was with India for those years, when sometimes he got into the field, he was just amazing as well. So these two that you just mentioned as well, they're amazing athletes. They run well, they move. They've obviously got good hands even without the gloves. So I find it easier with keepers come out that they don't take long to become good fielders.
And how much analysis is there of the precise fielding positions? Because, I mean, for instance, I noticed at the death the other night in Jaipur, which I know is a short, straight ground and wide, square.
In the pockets.
So you almost getting the field positioning right is important. And there were some big shots which went straight to the fielders. So there presumably is a lot of careful analysis on precise positioning.
100%. We're big on analysis here at Rajasthan. So Yagi is our fielding coach and I work closely with him. And we do a lot of that, the angles, the pockets, the hot spots, the right people in those areas is really crucial. You can't just suddenly have someone who's not very good out there. So that's crucial. And for different batsmen, they might just be just in front of square, or we might be just behind square, something like that. So we try and work on that. It's obviously in the heat of the moment, we don't get it right all the time. And left-hand, right-hand combinations make it difficult with all the noise that goes on here in the IPL. Some fielder might just end up in a hot spot and you're shouting and move, but it's too late. So we try and get it perfect, but it's not an exact science sometimes. But it's true. We try and work on those angles a lot.
Who do you see in the world game as the next great fielder or in the IPL? I mean, who is someone that you think, oh, my God, you know, he's just unbelievable?
Well, I think Riaan Parag and Dhruv, actually, the way they field. Riaan's like Superman and Dhruv can be as well. Obviously, he's a keeper. But those two on our side especially are amazing. They're so fast and they read it well. They want the ball. They want to make a difference. And like we said at the beginning, they're just fantastic. When you watch it, it's electric. And it inspires all the other fielders. The best that I coached ever was when I had that 3 years with Sri Lanka and Tilakaratna Dilshan. And he goes under the radar, but I've never seen anything like that. He was just incredible. He was that era with Ponting as well, who I still think was one of the best ever. He could field anywhere. He hit the stumps all the time. He was just amazing. And obviously Jonty over that era. There's been a few since then. There's a couple of good Aussies. Warner was fantastic. He's got a bit old now. And the chosen one, whatever he calls himself, Maxwell.
Maxwell. He can be Maxie. Pretty,
yeah. After Dilshan, I joined India and worked a lot with some of their great fielders like Rayner, all that crowd. And then Jadeja came through. Oh. And obviously, Jadu is like god of fielding at the moment. So that was a pleasure to work with him for like 3 years, which was... It's just a natural phenomenon, really.
And another great catcher in the world game, I always think, is Steve Smith, who goes wherever he goes. He just pouches him, doesn't he? I mean,
I forgot him. Look easy, you don't talk about him, eh?
There's a position in T20 which goes a little bit sort of uncelebrated, because it's an anonymous position. But I tell you who's a specialist in this position, mid-off, Chris Jordan. Now, that's quite a key posse, isn't it now? A mid-off. You know, whereas in your day, it was cover point or backward point or somewhere like that. In a way, mid-off is quite an interesting position, that. Just talk us through that.
Well, it's key now because, especially in that power play, some guys are trying to get over the top there and you're trying to hit a hard length or you don't want them to hit it there. So they'll still keep trying. And the way they hit the ball, like I said earlier, it's extraordinary now. It's coming so quick. So you need a fast fielder. You need someone slightly tall. You can't have someone sort of 5'6" fielding there. That's a crucial position. Also, they run. If there's been a few dots, they run to that position. So there's a chance for a run out. So normally in our day, you'd put your two sort of average fielders there and find leg and third man, but it's not anymore. So points hasn't, it's not that big a position anymore, unless it's someone really quick or like Bumrah and you know they're not looking to hit, or if it's an Ashwin, bowling on a wicket like that last over the other day. He wanted everybody in there, and there's no singles then, because you know they can't sort of read it. And so you mix and match with that, but that's a crucial position. And also some fields are set now where you always have your middle foot because you're wanting to hit leg side. So you still got your, like Josh does it well for us. He's gone there. He's very good.
So your routine on a daily basis at the IPL, people think, oh, well, you know, match starts at 7:30, you know, bit of a sort of lazy day before that, anything but. Your, like, give us your routine today. Today's a practice day. So what will your afternoon and evening involve?
So it's a sort of an evening practice or a late afternoon practice. So we normally meet up for breakfast. Mick Sanger and a few of the coaches, we talk about anything that we need or extra or it's anything on anyone's minds, that sort of thing. But to be honest, we've done a lot of prep. So today's been a bit more quiet. We're happy with the win, but obviously the analysts are busy sending us a whole heap of videos, what they're thinking for the next game, who we're playing against, that sort of stuff. So that's sent out to all the players. The meetings will only be tomorrow for the game in 2 days' time. The physios work hardest today, and the trainers, they'll do a little bit like that. And then it's an optional practice because we've practiced quite a lot leading up to that first game. We'll go to practice with maybe half the squad and all the reserves that didn't play. We'll really make sure they get good practice, good hits, so they're ready in case there's an injury or something like that. And then tomorrow would be a bigger day. All the meetings, bowling meetings, batting meetings, fielding meetings. And then we'd go for a light practice in the evening, maybe an hour, hour and a half, just to top up and ready for the next game, which is in the night.
And presumably the day of the match, there'd be a lot of planning there, including presumably, is there a bowling order? You know, you look at the opposition, whoever it is, and you're at home again, aren't you? So presumably you'll play a similar kind of team, couple of spinners, etc. Do you look at that match and say, right, if we field first, this is going to be the order of the bowlers, pretty much, given unforeseen, unbelievable circumstances?
Yeah, definitely. You know, I can't say too much about it, but I can talk generally about it. But yeah, we're very lucky. We've got a great analytic team led by Giles, who's just fantastic. And he's got three or four guys. So they give us what they think, sort of a bowling order, a batting order against this bowler, the matchups. Nothing's left unturned. Not like when we played. You think, oh, well, I know how he bowls. I'm just going to go and see how it goes. That sort of thing. We sort of knew, but it's so nice to have that side of things now because it's sort of, you say, oh, yeah, I was thinking that. Or no, I wasn't, but geez, let's talk about that. So it's changed a lot for the good. And I love it. Like, I'm head coach of the Barbados side, and I really love that information. Like, for instance, sometimes when you've got a batting order and you're feeling you would have been in those situations, or do you think we should send him or should we send him? And you're going, but if you've got your analyst like Jalo or Punish right next to you, they'll go, well, no, he should go. And then you go, okay, let's go with that. So it's fantastic. It's made it easier for us, and often it's right.
Michael Vaughan said the other day, I think it was probably clickbait, but he said the other day about the England coaching staff, he said, oh, they're just, you know, sort of backslappers and clapping for everyone. How do you deal with, in your case, you know, something where you don't like what someone's done? I mean, is it important to be able to not be just a back scratcher, if you like?
So you're saying if a player doesn't perform well?
Well, you know, if they don't do kind of what you suggested they did and it failed, and there's a sort of a sequence of these, you know, it's a difficult one to manage, I suppose, isn't it?
I think our policy is sort of when you've got the trust of the players, I think that's important. Then if he's done what we think he's trying to do but mis-executed the shot or the ball, absolutely fine. That's just a human error. But if he's tried something completely against the game plan, which we've talked about the last sort of few days, then you'd have a word with him afterwards. And it's good. It's sort of player driven as well, all these reviews we have. And normally they'll come up and say, sorry, I didn't do well there. I did the wrong thing. Apologies. So But yeah, I think you have to be like that. Otherwise, he can keep doing that, can't he? You've got to sort of be strict. Sanger's pretty big on that stuff.
And overall, you know, do you prefer coaching or playing? I mean, can you compare the two?
You know, yeah. I left while I was still playing. Tom Moody asked me to go to Sri Lanka, and that was like a huge decision. And I've never looked back. I absolutely love helping people. Because I felt I should have been a better player. So when I became a coach, I don't want that to happen to anyone else. So it's like that's how I sort of believe in my coaching side of things. Fielding, no. I was happy with my fielding. But batting, I reckon I could have been better. So that's it's a drive for me, and it has been. So it's like, no, you've got so much talent. Let's how do we get that out of you?
And good to see you're still involved in the fun side of the game. I see some streaks of dye in your hair. So talk me through the Holi Festival yesterday. What happened?
It's we went downstairs. There's a grass area up there, and it just goes ballistic. There's just this pink powder everywhere. There's hose pipes, water guns, and the youngsters just go crazy. They're just going and they put stuff all in your face, your hair, and they're spraying you with water, rugby tackling you down, and it just goes berserk. It's very nice. Great fun for about an hour. But as you see, I'm still stuck in pink. And I'm the good one. There's some people that are still bright pink.
And you're top of the table at the moment as well. I know it's early days.
Yeah, no, it's nice to see, hey. But as you say, there's still 2 months to go, and it's just, it was nice. It's been a nice preparation. Guys are all looking good, so we just keep it together and one game at a time, as they say.
I mean, is it a sort of ordeal in a way, the IPL? I mean, I've been on tour with you before, and I did a week or two, and I was exhausted, you know, doing four games and about six flights or something. I mean, how is it? How do you manage to get through it?
I think this is my 9th or 10th one. But yeah, you're very tired come the end of it. And you get home and you sort of don't realize how tired you can be. But everyone's become good at looking after themselves. So if you need a morning off or you need a day off, and you just tell us. And even the coaches, we do that for the coaches as well. Because sometimes, as you said, this one is nearly 10 weeks long now from the time we turned up to the finals. So and there's 14, 15 flights within that maybe. Lots of travel, lots of late nights. That's the one that gets people, I think.
You're not in bed until like 3 or something, are you, after a match?
Yeah. And then normally you've only just got back at 1 or 2, so you can't sleep anyway. So that's the sort of thing. You need to change your sleeping patterns, and you just need to look after yourself, eating and try and get your sleep and do a bit of exercise. But the players now, like we've got maybe 3 physios, 3 masseuses, people, medical staff. It's really good. So the players are looked after, which is the most important thing.
Yeah, actually, I noticed on a list of one team's support staff, they had about 4 specialist sidearm throwers, you know, and actual throwdowns. There are throwdown specialists, aren't there? And sidearm specialists.
We've got about 6 and we've got about 18 net bowlers, quickies, spinners. So it's really good. The players just get exactly what they want when they want it. And that's ideal because it saves our arms as I'm getting older.
Well, Trevor Penny there, who's the assistant coach at Rajasthan Royals. And just to underline that point about how demanding it can be in these franchise leagues, you have the big hype around that game on Sunday. Gujarat Titans are home to Mumbai Indians. Hardik Pandya going back to Ahmedabad. He won the title 1 year with Gujarat Titans. They lost in the final last year. Huge crowd at the Narendra Singh Modi Stadium on Sunday. So they play that game. It's a really intense game and a really tight finish, and Gujarat just winning the match. Today they're in Chennai, which is a huge distance away from Ahmedabad. So basically play, travel, play, and you know, 2 huge games as well, Mumbai Indians and then away to the defending champions Chennai Super Kings, you know, a couple of days later.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. And it's not just, I mean, although actually air travel in India is much easier than it used to be. I noticed Michael Atherton actually writing about his winter in the Times the other day and you know, spending best part of 3.5-4 months in India with the World Cup and then the Test match series. And he said he only lost 1 piece of luggage, and he actually found they found it soon after. In fact, I was with him that day as we were waiting for his luggage on the carousel, and then it didn't turn up and he was getting quite grumpy, and then it did turn up. So you don't have the kind of awful problems that many of us have had in past tours abroad. Like, I remember going around the airport in Mumbai from the domestic to the international terminal and put the suitcases on the top of a little taxi, and two of them fell off on the route round. So, it is much easier air travel in India now. But you can't underestimate the exhaustion of fielding, say, in those huge stadiums in Ahmedabad, where, they've got 120,000 people, and it's deafening there, isn't it? We've both been there, stood out there when there's a full house, and it's just, it shakes you to the bone, actually, when there's a roar. And, of course, the same in Chennai. Now, when Dhoni comes out, I was really waiting, hoping in their first Chennai game that Dhoni would stroll out, with five to win or something. And I just, because you listen to people on Instagram. I was listening the other day, actually, to Brad Haddin on another podcast talking about, highlights of his career. And he said, one of the things is, actually, being in Chennai when Dhoni walks out to bat, there's nothing else like it. We've played the recording on here before on this podcast. I'm not going to do it today, but it actually is deafening. It's like an explosion almost going off in your ear. And that has an impact on you, which probably takes you a long time to overcome.
Mm. Yeah, okay. It is intense. I suppose people will be saying, well, there are lots of other people doing, intense jobs. And of course, that is true. There are, you think of doctors, nurses or whatever, working in A&E. I think the point is, it is demanding, isn't it? It is physically and mentally demanding, especially if you're, fully involved in the game, if you have to bat, for a long time, and then you have to field. I suppose the one sort of caveat these days is that you might have a situation where you don't field and then you just bat for a bit. Shivam Dubey in the opening game, I mean, he joined the match, I think it was from the top of my head, and in the 14th over for Chennai Super Kings and won the game. So, he had, 28 balls or something. That was his sole involvement in the game. Didn't field, impact player, won the game. But I suppose that brings its own mental demands, doesn't it? Something that really struck in my mind about David Visa, when he said, when I practice, I don't face the new ball. I might just bat for 10 balls in the nets because that's all I'm going to bat in the middle. And I hadn't really sort of thought of it like that, but that is really, that's this idea of training specifically for the job you're going to do. And I suppose that's true with, lots of Trevor Penny's fielding drills. You talked earlier, didn't you, about, you'd have high catches whacked to you, and you're not going to, in the championship season, you might get a couple at fine leg, mightn't you? You'll be asleep for them, obviously, so you'll hit you on the head and go for six. But, it is that idea of specific training for those, roles that you're going to play when you actually go out on the field.
I think, actually, I did only take about one high catch in my career, I think, and it was an absolute screamer. It was a top edge off Graham Gooch at Chelmsford, and I was half awake at fine leg, and I saw the opportunity because it spiraled over the keeper's head and went towards the boundary, but very high. And I just legged it in. There's a vague hope of getting somewhere near it. I sort of hurled my body forwards, and the ball stuck in one hand, sliding, diving catch. And I think no one was more surprised than me. Gooch, I think, almost wanted to see a retake or something because he couldn't believe I'd caught it either. And he had to go, and he's never forgiven me.
I'm amazed you didn't bring that up on our podcast with him a couple of weeks ago.
I forgot, actually. Well, he wouldn't remember anyway. If you've played 1,000 innings in first-class cricket, you're not going to remember a top edge caught at 27, at Chelmsford in kind of May 1987, are you? Mm.
No, but the thing is, you remember it. And that's the thing about a great piece of fielding, isn't it? A great catch or a run out, in a strange way, they sort of really stick in your mind, don't they? Those individual incidents. I can still think about catches you've taken more than perhaps innings I've played, in your sort of club career. It's a level down or whatever, or two or three levels down. But you still remember those catches. I'm sure people who are listening to this will think about that, will resonate with them. Yeah, I can really remember that catch I took against old Chumley Seconds on a Sunday in September or whatever, diving one-hander or something like that.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's something, actually, that it's a bit like a screaming shot into the top corner in football, or the occasional absolute belter of a drive right down the middle with a little bit of left-hand draw. 200 yards down the fairway, those sort of isolated moments of exhilaration are probably what, you know, sustains a lot of amateur sportsmen. And actually, it's true of professionals as well, because you all want to shine. You all want to be a star, be a hero. And actually, you've got more opportunities potentially in fielding than maybe in batting or bowling.
OK, Oz, we talked about your brilliant catch to get rid of Graham Gooch. I think we should end on, what was your most ignominious piece of fielding, apart from falling asleep at fine leg? Drop catch, cost a match.
Oh, too many to name.
Too many.
Okay. Well, I've got two, though. One was a NatWest semi-final at Old Trafford against Lancashire. The Lancashire side of the late 80s, early 90s, very strong one-day side, probably the best side in the country. Gihan Mendis, who formerly played for Sussex, a Sri Lankan, but then opened the batting for Lancashire for a few years. Graham Fowle, a fantastic player. He just sort of clothed a drive early in the game to me at sort of shortish mid-off, and I fluffed it, and he got 100 man of the match. And that was definitely one nadir. And probably the first and best was playing as a 16-year-old for my club, Ealing, in a tour match against an Australian touring team. And I shelled a catch when their top player was on a duck, and he got 100. And I was awarded the Dummy of the Day award in the pavilion afterwards, which was the donation to me of a drink called an earthquake, which probably students of a certain generation might remember. It was basically six shorts, you know, gin, vodka, brandy, whiskey, tequila, and one other in one glass, topped up with pineapple juice, which you had to drink down in one. And bear in mind, I was 16 and I had to do it. And the room when I went to bed was spinning for a good few hours after that, just to make me not forget my terrible cack-handedness.
Mm. But you obviously didn't, Yoz, because you went on to drop loads in your career. You could have said no to the drink, Yoz. I'm not drinking this. I'm 16. Anyway, there we go. Interesting things used to go on in cricket dressing rooms in your day.
Can we just leave that there, actually? Because anyway, your dog's barking, so that means we've got to stop. So that's it for today. By the way, don't forget our sister podcast, Storylines, with Melissa Story and Nikki Chowdhury. They've had some fun and games recently, actually, and they've both been on the TMS commentary this week, haven't they?
Yeah, they have. And Melissa was trying to talk us through playing the ramp shot, saying how scary it is when that ball's coming towards her. Anyway, that's on a previous podcast. Have a listen to that and catch up with them.
Yes, and on the subject of women's cricket, we have a big guest in the Virtual Cricket Club tomorrow night, Wednesday night. It's Charlotte Edwards, Lottie, who's a guest in the World's Best Cricket Club, worldsbestcc.com. You can join us and ask her a question and be part of the live conversation. So that's the World's Best Cricket Club, worldsbestcc.com, with Charlotte Edwards tomorrow night, Wednesday night, 8 p.m. Go to the website and click on the link there and you can become a member of our club, which also has a very active WhatsApp group as well, with members all around the world talking about cricket, where they've been, what they've watched, what they've seen and what they've read, actually, as well, which is quite interesting. Our next podcast will be previewing the County Championship, which is only about 10 days away now. So exciting for all the English County fans as well, with that coming up. I hope the weather improves. It just feels like it's getting that bit better now, doesn't it? So we'll be back at the weekend to preview the County Championship. In the meantime, thanks for listening. Don't eat too many Easter eggs.
Sports Social Podcast Network.